Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Yes. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal, and I'm in the studio with Evan Taylor, cook, engineer, all-around person, and glad to have him. Donna is off doing some cooking things today. Here we are on a beautiful, beautiful summer day in beautiful downtown Ames. This has been quite the summer. We're coming to the end of June. We're sliding into a fine, fine July. And we're here around our kitchen table in the community radio studios of KHOI. If you want to find out more about this radio station, go to khoifm.org. This radio station is probably not like a lot of other radio stations you listen to. We are made up of volunteers, and we are the voice of the community. We do shows because we like to do shows. So there we have it. So listen. You can listen live. You can listen at khoifm.org. Because all of these shows are streamed. They are available for download, podcast. Share them. Find out what's going on by going to that fine website. Today, some news from the Danilana Kitchen News Department. Tick 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 tick. That's the ticker tape. Yes, it is. We've got a fine news department here. It may not be up to the minute, but it's within the last week at least. So here's what we've got for news today. News items from the Ames Main Street Farmers Market. We've got a little bit about food, about fiber, and about livestock. First, the food. Ah, yes. Beautiful day at the farmers market in downtown Ames last Saturday. They had a bacon contest. Bacon. Things made with bacon. What is not to like? Lots of people enjoyed. People tasted it. They did have a panel of judges, but ever so much more important, they had regular farmers market customer folks come and taste all of the good stuff and also vote for their favorite. The People's Choice Award is always a nice thing. It was the Bacon Sweet and Savory Contest. There were 318 votes cast, picked the People's Choice winner, and they were The Little Smokies by Myrna Canuso. And she also won the first place. Now, get your mind around this. I think this is just brilliant. She made bacon-wrapped plantains. Now, isn't that a good idea? So, Little Smokies, bacon-wrapped plantains. There were also many other good things. Bacon pineapple bread. Bacon jam. Bacon brownies. And bacon ranch dip and some other stuff, too. Bacon, always a good idea. So that was the farmer's market last Saturday. Also, more farmer's market news. In the fiber department, there is a woman who was on our show a couple weeks ago named Jenny Wilder. She and her husband have a little booth there that they sell soap and all kinds of body care items. And also, Jenny is a spinner and a weaver, and she dyes things. The Wilder's booth is called Herbal Bliss Soaps. Say that fast. Herbal Bliss Soaps. And stop by her booth sometime, because she was up to the darndest thing. She has been dyeing with interesting vegetable fibers. A couple weeks ago, she dyed some wonderful things with rhubarb leaves. And this week, she showed me a silk scarf that she made with sumac leaves and cherry bark. She said she dyed it and then let the dyes set, how it has to do, by just rolling it up in a ball and putting it in her driveway for 3 weeks. That's called solar dyeing. Somehow that works. Ask her about it. It was just really nice. It's nice to know you can do that with things you find that grow right out of the ground. All right, and now our news item that has to do with livestock. Another past guest here on the Don Alana Kitchen. From Dr. G's Farm, that was Garen and Christy Buttermore. They had something to share in the livestock department. They brought their dachshund. Now, no, the dachshund was not for sale, but this was a dachshund unlike any others. This was a winner of the dachshund races that were held in Des Moines. So we got to meet a real live racing dachshund who was evidently really full of himself. He had a little sparkly rhinestone collar on. His name was Hugo, yes, and he was available for pawtographs, if you would like. Yes, he would put his little paw print on things, yes. So that's the news from Ames Street Farmers Market. And June is Dairy Month. I grew up hearing that. I grew up in Wisconsin. You go, June is Dairy Month. I think that was just because it was a good excuse to eat more ice cream. The cows are happy this time of year. They've had green grass. They're producing well. So I kind of dipped back into the Don Alana Kitchen archives and looked for some things about cows. In September of 2016, we talked to Megan Filbert about the latest in cow technology. You know, it's always good to keep up with new technology. We have a special guest here in the studio, Megan Filbert from Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Yes, Megan Filbert is the livestock coordinator at PFI. So welcome, Megan.
Thank you for having me, Lana and Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
You told me about, I guess it isn't all that new, but I had never heard about it. Robotic milking for cows. So tell me, is this true, Megan?
Yes, it is true. And it's happening in Iowa, as well as other parts of the country. We, PFI, had a field day at Laura Jones and her father, Steve Leisure's farm, which is in Cedar County, close to the Mississippi River, eastern Iowa. There's not too many dairies left in that area, but I heard from Steve, the farm host. He told me that there are at least 25 dairies in Iowa with robots milking cows, and
wow,
there could be potentially up to 50 or so.
I'm shocked.
I am just fascinated. First off, I had no idea. Second off, how does this work?
Yeah, what's it look like?
Yeah, so as best I can explain it over the air, basically, cows walk in a single file line. They walk into a little pen. It's not really a stanchion. It's just kind of a feeding station. And on one side of that pen or station, there's a robotic arm. And this arm has lasers on it. And those lasers are able to detect each teat of the udder. And they then proceed to clean the udder and clean the teats, wipe them down with iodine, do all of the pre-milking.
Wait, how did they get the cow to stand in the right place?
So the cow...
Is this like scanning your book at the library where you have the barcode?
Actually, the cow has a chip in its ear, tag. And that chip then knows exactly which cow it is, and it lets down the correct amount of feed for each cow, depending on her weight and her milk production.
All right, so she's already standing in the right place.
That's right.
Just like they used to automatically go, cows know to go to the stanchion that's theirs.
Exactly.
Right.
So each cow comes in, and it stands in the correct place, the feed is let down, and then gates are closed for her milking time. So she can't back up or go move forward during the milking.
So it is like a stanchion in that way.
Somewhat, yes, yes. So as she's eating, this robotic arm is put to work, and it is cleaning the udder, and then it prepares for milking, and then it actually starts to milk. So
I'm sorry, but I'm imagining a Walt Disney cartoon where the hand comes down with a Mickey Mouse glove on it, has a sponge in it, feels around the udder, and then snaps the thing on.
It's like that, but just a little more computerized and technical.
Good. So, I hope there's a little bit of humor in it. Good.
Yes. It's really fascinating to watch, and it sounds scarier than it actually looks when you're watching the robot milk the cow. It's almost like therapeutic, and it's just, and you can tell that the cow is actually, it's working very well for this cow. Laura did tell me that the absolute best part of having this robotic milker is that it milks the cow the same way every single time, which a human may or may not do.
Okay.
So really, cows love consistency.
Okay. Oh.
All animals love consistency and routine, especially dairy cows. So therefore, the consistency of this robotic milker is...
So that's like consistency of pressure.
Exactly.
Timing.
All of those things. Exactly. So it's the actual act of milking, sucking the milk from the teat with like a vacuum suction, is the same like
as
it would be.
As a milk machine,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. It's a milk machine, but it's attached to its robotic arm. And the other really fascinating thing about this technology is that there's a computerized system that is measuring the milk output from each quarter of the udder. So you can actually read milk output from each teat, which is something that you can't do with just modern.
All right. Does that if a teat is not producing as much, does that clue you into like maybe there's
mastitis?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So
wait, we better say what mastitis is.
And mastitis is really just an infection of the teat. Usually the teat end. It's a bit of bacteria that may get up into the teat and then cause an inflammation, which then causes, well, for one, it hurts the dairy cow to be milked, and two, it causes some extra cells to be present in the milk, which is affects milk quality. It degrades milk quality, mm-hmm, so we don't want that.
So Plus, they can get sick and sick and sicker if you don't catch it.
Exactly. So
it's not good.
It is. We are able to detect mastitis in one teat or maybe more and not milk that teat and treat it right away as soon as we possibly see any sort of difference in observation with that computer technology.
So does that mean somebody's sitting watching the screens instead of the cows?
Well, so you're kind of doing both. You are able to watch the computer as the robot is milking. Mm-hmm. You can also get readouts after milking every day. Any time during the day, you can go to your computer and get readouts on these cows. The other thing is they're also wearing an activity monitor, which Laura described as a Fitbit for cows.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And so she'll know when a cow is not being as active, and maybe that means that cow's getting sick. So she can go into the barn and then observe that specific cow and pay more closer attention to that cow before she would have known anything is up. There's also times when the activity monitor is showing more activity than normal, and that would mean to the farmer that your cow's in heat potentially, or it's pasture season, your cows are out on pasture and just getting more exercise in that way. So it's pretty cool to think about and to be able to monitor your cows in this way. And so because this robot can be very consistent with its milking, you're getting higher milk quality. So there's...
Does that mean lower bacterial
that's
counts?
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. It means lower bacterial counts.
That's good for all of us.
So they measure this as somatic cell count. And
you want to say what a somatic cell
sure,
is?
Sure. All cows give off somatic cells. They're always present in the milk, but you want them, that count, to be as low as possible. And under 500,000 is good.
Wait,
it sounds like a lot.
What's a somatic cell?
It's, I believe it is a part of the white blood cells, I believe, that that are just present in the milk, that are basically cells that are sloughing off, mm-hmm, through the teats into our milk. And over a certain level, they're of concern, but under a certain level, no problem.
So somatic cell count also gives a view of the health of the animal.
That's right.
So if the animal's having some kind of minor low-level infection, the somatic cell count will go up. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So when there's mastitis on the teat, or when the teat end is injured in some way and there's a bit of infection and inflammation, you know, all of our all of our good cells that are healing are rushing to that site to heal, and you're going to see more presence of cells sloughed off into the milk, indicating there's some sort of inflammation and infection that's being healed. Mm-hmm. So Laura said that since they got the robot, which they started milking robotically about 16 months ago.
Okay, wait. How many cows are they milking?
So they milk 60 cows.
60 cows with one robot?
With one robot. So
how much does a robot cost?
Yeah, she said everything with all of the bells and whistles, the gates, the computers, it cost $260,000. So it's quite expensive, and one robot can handle about max 65 cows. So if they want to increase their herd, they have built in the space to actually put in another robot.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, the cows are self-feeding, and they stand in line. How do you convince a cow to do this?
Well, because there's feed there for
it. Oh, all right.
And because – so – what Lana is saying is that the cows basically are milking themselves, and they're milking themselves whenever they feel like they want to be milked.
Instead, so it's not like twice a day they line up?
No, it's any time over the 24 hours of the day.
So they unlearn coming in twice a day, and they learn to just come when pressure happens?
Laura did say that for the first 3 weeks, it was kind of chaotic in the barn while the cows were learning because they love a routine. They love consistency, so it threw them off. But eventually, now, new cows on the farm, you know, fresh heifers that are now being milked for the first time, they get the hang of it from watching other cows.
It seems to me curious because the cows have been trained for so long to come in at a certain time, and so they don't just, like, all line up and wait for this one milker?
She said at certain times of the day, and depending on milk productivity. So potentially, if you had a pasture-based system in the middle of the summer when there's really lush grass, they're going to have a lot of milk to release. So there may be periods of the day when there is a line waiting for the milker.
Well, they can probably all take a number or something. You know?
Exactly.
Stand in line, yeah. Chew their cud.
Yes.
Well, but they are sort of herd-oriented. They're used to all doing everything at the same time.
Right.
So it's not like one of them will say, oh, gee, I'm really feeling full, and she'll amble in by herself and
she
plug
may,
up.
And then others will follow.
They'll think, oh, me too?
And I've seen there was one cow at a time, and there wasn't a line. And it may just been the time of the day or the season. But I've also seen other robotic dairies where there is a line of about five cows waiting. So it's really interesting to think about because it's kind of, in a way, closer to mimicking nature than milking a cow twice a day.
Because the babies usually have at it all
I've
the
heard
time.
That calves naturally will suckle seven times a day for very short intervals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's almost letting that cow relieve herself in that way mm-hmm. whenever she feels it.
So given the option, how often are cows coming in to be milked?
Yeah. So Laura said that the average on their farm is 2.2 times a day.
Okay.
Some cows spike that average, and they're at three times a day or more, and some cows are around 1.8. But on average, the cows are still milking themselves mm-hmm. 2.2 mm-hmm. times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it does depend on if they have access to pasture in the summer or if they're in the barn during the winter because they have a farther way to walk in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're hanging out outside a little bit more. Or if it's a really hot day, maybe they're actually coming inside to have some shade and they'll milk themselves more often.
Okay. So for the farmer, obviously they're getting all these important metrics and sort of things. But does that mean, for example, they don't have to get up on Sunday morning at, you know, 5:30 a.m.
Exactly.
More like 3.
So, Laura,
tell me about the impact on dairy farmers that
and
now
quality
have
of life
on the people.
Yes. So, Laura did tell us that when she was milking without a robot, she was milking at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m.
Oh.
And mm-hmm. after she had her third child, it was just almost impossible. She basically said she was not being a very nice person to people she'd encounter during the day.
Stress, yes.
Yes,
that
tired
happens when
stress.
You have three children, even without cows.
So the amazing thing about this robotic milking is the flexibility it gives the farmer. It doesn't mean that there's less labor. it means that the type of labor shifts, your management shifts. So you actually spend more time observing cows or maybe tinkering with fixing up the machine or the computer instead of actually hands-on milking the cows. So you're still working basically just as hard. It's just a more flexible schedule.
Right. I assume that there is a robotic milking tech number you can call, because if this goes down, this is not good for
exactly.
the cows.
They do have a backup generator, but yes, their nearest tech person is 45 minutes away. So that's always something to consider, because I've been on some farms. This was in upstate New York, which is a big dairy state, that were transitioning over to robots or wanted to, but realized that the nearest tech person was 2 hours away. What we do see now, as robots become more popular in the dairy industry, there's more and more service available, more and more tech people, and the price is coming down.
Well, but what kind of backup do you have? I mean, what do you do? Get out the milk pail and the stool if it all fails and start doing it all manually?
Good question. I think
you've got to have a backup.
Yeah. I think that would probably be like down the list on what they would do. They still have their old parlor. But they did say they have the backup generator and that a tech person's able to come.
But that's only the electrical part.
That's right. Yeah. You know. A tech person's able to come in 45 minutes and they'll do that around the clock. And at this point, Laura said she's getting really good with troubleshooting all of the little finicky things that happen with the technology. And she maintains it a little bit every day, and it's performed very, very well. So they feel it's reliable.
Well, this when you think about it, this isn't such a huge leap, because we're already dealing with automatic milk machines and milking parlors and bulk tanks. I mean, a lot of stuff has been automated, but this is a big change as far as timing for the farmer and milking for the cows. They can be on their own schedule.
Yeah. How can you finance something that large on a 60-cow dairy?
Yeah, good question. So,
I mean, that's a major, major investment.
Yeah, Laura did say that now, they used to have someone full-time there to help milk. They had a full-time employee. Now they have one woman who works like 10 hours a week, so 20 hours every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. just maybe for some relief milking and to do some chores. So they're saving, she said they're saving about $15,000 to $30,000 a year in not having that full-time employee. Mm-hmm. And she just, over years, that cost will hopefully pay for itself. So they felt with saving money and paying another employee and quality of life was worth the investment.
We're talking about robotic milking on the farm. It's a new thing, but it's not a brand new thing. It's been around. Cows are learning new things, and we can too. You're listening to KHOI. This is Donalena Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Was a little bit of music called The Year of Jubilo. I think I've also heard it called Kingdom Coming, too. Kind of gets us in the mood for marching down the street there in the 4th of July parade. Something else that happens this time of year, we're just kind of getting through with the cherry season, but the mulberry trees are just doing great things this year. There are many mulberry trees, and most of them are just planted as ornamentals. But they're wonderfully edible. A very delicate fruit. My favorite way to eat a mulberry is to stand underneath the tree and just eat them. They don't travel well. They don't last. Or I take my cereal bowl out and just fill it up. It's a thing to do this time of year. So the squirrels, the birds, and I, yes, we're there. We're there. Yes, we are. There's a black mulberry, there is a white mulberry, and there is a red mulberry. In the leaves of the white mulberry are the staple diet of the silkworms. So think about that. That's where the silk comes from. They tried to introduce silkworms to Britain in the 17th century, but made the mistake of moving a black mulberry to Britain, which did well, but the silkworms did not like it. Oh, also, the black mulberry is used in folk medicine, notably in the treatment of ringworm, so keep that in mind. And here is another fun fact about mulberries. Unripe mulberries and the green leaves and shoots of the mulberry plant contain a white resinous fluid, latex, that when swallowed is liable to cause gastric upset. However, it can also result in a heightening of the senses and an intoxication that may thereafter lead to hallucinations. So be careful out there. Yes, yes. Let's go back to thinking about cows. Here's another encore interview from the Donalana Kitchen Archives from November 2016. Today, we meet a young farmer. He raises cows, he milks them, and I heard someone say once, blessed are the cheesemakers.
Amen.
Well, yes, they are blessed. Today in our studio, we have
Kevin Dietzel.
Kevin Dietzel, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Good.
Kevin is a young, new farmer with a lovely wife and two children, right?
Two children.
Young children.
And three and five.
Three and five. And he...
Good.
So Kevin has Lost Lake Farm.
Tell us about Lost Lake Farm.
First of all, where is it?
Just north of Jewell, so we're maybe 30 miles north of Ames.
So Kevin is truly our local cheesemaker.
The reason that our farm is called Lost Lake Farm is because we are at the north end and on the north shores of what used to be Lake Cairo.
Really? What happened to it?
It was a 1,500-acre shallow lake. Some people called it Mud Lake, depending what record you looked at. It was maybe 8 feet at the deepest, but...
But it was a natural geological formation.
It was a natural geological formation. But it was 1,500 acres. That's pretty big.
Oh, my.
And they, in the 1890s, all the landowners in that area decided they wanted farmland there, and they drained it. And they did a humongous project, and there are some of the biggest drainage ditches I've ever seen that were dug from 1895 to 1898 or something like that.
Right, and it's right on your farm.
It's on the eastern border of our farm is one of the big drainage ditches. And if you are driving on Highway 69 north of Jewell, you can see the main drainage ditch of all of Lake Cairo that goes by the side of Highway 69 there, just right next to the golf course. It is humongous, and it feeds into the Skunk River.
And what kind of soil does that leave you guys with?
That leaves us with a little piece of Minnesota. It's called... our soil type on the lake bottom. Not all of our farm is actual lake bottom. We have some upland soils too, but we have what is called blue earth mucky silt loam.
Blue earth mucky silt loam. That sounds like a poem, kind of,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Or
it
an
is
ice
so
cream
named
flavor.
Because the first of that type was found in blue earth, Minnesota. And it's not a true muck soil, but it is a very high organic matter soil, very deep. But we also have some 150-year-old bur oaks and kind of a steep shoreline that are a remnant of, they were never cut down because it didn't work very well for cropland because it's sloping in Hamilton County.
And how many acres do you have?
Roughly 80. So we rent that from my uncle and aunt who purchased it in order to rent it to us.
And I believe it's called Dietzel's Folly?
Dietzel's Folly.
Yes.
Oh.
That's what his uncle calls it.
Yes. He has spent some time in England, and he got some of the English sense of humor from there and put that onto
there. But that's very good of him to support his nephew, the young farmer.
Yeah. It took us quite a few years to find the right arrangement and then find the right land. It wasn't like I had this favorite uncle who was like, hey, I hear you like farming. Why don't I buy a farm for you? No, it was probably a 10-year process.
So, Kevin, why cows? Farmers can farm a lot of things. Why for you? Why did cows end up in your
life? Why cheese from the cows?
Yeah, why? Tell me about your cheese journey.
Well, first I'll answer the cows question. I fell in love with cows probably when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, me too. I'm very envious of you. I always say, I've been a milkmaid many lifetimes. It's just, yes. Oh, Kevin.
So what kind of cows
do we have?
We have various breeds. We started out, the first heifer calves we bought were Brown Swiss from the Gilbert family, Gibraltar Farms. They're near Iowa Falls.
Uh-huh.
So we bought some heifer calves from them and bottle fed them. We still have those two. One of our cheeses is named after one of them. It's called Ingrid's Pride, and Ingrid was one of our first two cows. Oh. We have been crossing to Normandy, which is a French breed.
And what color are they?
They are red and white. So and a lot
like
of them
spotted,
have
like a deeper
brindled.
Brindled. Ooh, pretty. And what are they smaller like the Swiss?
They're smaller than a Swiss.
Oh.
Swiss are about as big as they come. Some people call them elephants of the dairy world.
They're bigger than Holstein?
They can be often. Holsteins and Swiss will rival each other size-wise. Now, the original actual Swiss brown fee are smaller, but the American brown Swiss is a big breed.
We blew them up, yeah.
Yeah, and they produce more, too.
Yeah.
And why are we bringing in the Normandy? What's the appeal of that for you?
Well, they're pretty, and they do...
yes!
They do really well on a rough diet, on pasture.
You're grass feeding, right?
Right. We do give them a little bit of grain in the parlor, essentially as a treat to lure them in.
So they want it, yeah. So they cooperate.
Yeah. But they also have really good quality milk. They have high butter fat, high protein. Not as high as a Jersey, but they will rival Brown Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other portions of the type of capercaseine, which is important for cheese making.
And are they what's that called, the new typing that they're putting into milk?
Is the A2?
A2?
They
red.
Have a high frequency of A2.
Uh-huh.
And what pray tell is an A2?
It is...
A2 Brute? No, that's not it.
No, it's A, like capital A, okay. The beginning letter of the alphabet.
So okay. A2, A2. So there's A2, A1, A2. So it's a genotype. That's why it has the weird thing. It has to do with the type of protein.
And supposedly the A2 milk is less allergenic, right?
That's my understanding.
That's how they're pushing it these days.
Yes. But there's another... And I'm blanking on what it's called right now, but it's another genotype that has to do with the capercaseine, which is not health related, but more cheese yield and cheese quality related.
Oh,
and
yes.
They are also have a higher gene frequency of that genotype in the Normandy breed. A neat thing about Normandy breed, they are the breed, if you've ever had the Camembert cheese, that's from the same region, so that's from Normandy.
Okay. Now I see where you're going with this, Kevin. I've had some of Kevin's soft rind cheeses.
Oh, that's what that is. How many cows does one need, or how many do you have?
What can you
to make
put
a
on
herd?
80 acres?
How many?
Let's see. So we have right now 11 of our own cows that we're milking. We have 4 of somebody else's that are on a lease. arrangement.
So they live at your house?
They live at our place.
So they're all getting the same pasture and the same management, basically.
Yeah. So essentially, it's somebody else who's trying to start a herd and doesn't have a farm yet, and so wanted to buy some cows. And
okay,
it's
does
also
that still qualify you as a closed herd for your cheese making?
Yes, because they're all on site.
Okay. Because in the cheesemaker's world, having a, quote, closed herd means you are growing your own milk and you have a lot more control over the quality of the milk, the sanitation of the milk. It's a big plus in the cheesemaking world for
right.
a premium product.
Yeah, the only difference, we do not have ownership of these cows.
Yeah.
And
okay,
so
their
calves.
They're in your herd.
They're in our herd. We have a year contract. They've been here for 3 months.
Okay,
they
so
will
you
be
have
here through.
You're milking 15?
We're milking 15.
Now, that seems small. Being from Wisconsin, that's a small herd. But that probably means that these cows get a lot of attention.
And
what kind of parlor do you have?
Iowa State Extension design called the Trans-Iowa Parlor, which is essentially a low-cost parlor design. So it's a pit. I stand down, you know, maybe 3 feet below the cows, and they're on a platform elevated.
And you do
and,
two at a time?
We milk four at a time.
Four at a time. Is this
just
like
on
the one that
side.
Francis Tickey has? In-
it would be, but a lot smaller.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's very civilized that we call the place to milk cows a parlor. It sounds so nice, a nice gathering place.
We forget that Kevin, in addition to milking the cows, he has to make the cheese. That's a whole other business, right?
It is. That's a more than full-time job right there. Is just
okay,
making
so
the
tell
cheese.
Me what a cheese-making day looks like.
Well, my alarm goes off at 3:30. A.M. I go out, and the first thing I have to do is I have to test the milk for antibiotic residue. This is a requirement
this
by the
in
state.
The milk in the vat, right?
The milk, it's still in the bulk tank. Before
yeah,
I ever
tank.
Transfer
okay.
it, so the bulk tank is where the milk is stored between milkings and cooled.
Mm-hmm.
So before I ever transfer it, so I know and can document to the state that there's no antibiotic residue, even though I know I haven't given them any antibiotics. I still have to document that there's
the
no
rules
residue.
To follow.
So I have to do that, and that takes about an hour. Then
really,
I pump the milk over into the pasteurizer.
Give me an idea of how many gallons we're talking about here on a typical day.
Right now it's 60 to 70 gallons every other day.
Okay.
So I pump it over and immediately start heating it up. And the vat, which is also the pasteurizer, I do it all in the same vat.
So what method
it
are you using? Low?
It's a low temperature vat pasteurization. And so this is a jacketed vat. It has hot water in the vat mm-hmm. so that it's not just getting heated from
right,
the bottom.
Right, because you don't want to burn the, you don't want that burned
right, and you
smell.
Want even all around mm-hmm. the sides and the bottom. And so I heat it up to 145 degrees. The milk has to be 145 degrees, and then you pump. You're putting steam into the top. The air temperature in the top of the vat has to be 150 degrees, and when those two conditions are met, then you hold it there for 30 minutes.
Is there an agitator in the tank?
There's an agitator in the tank that
so
is
the
stirring
whole thing
it
is that temperature.
That,
okay.
That whole time. And mm-hmm. so it is documenting the air temperature and product temperature as you're doing this. And that's, you know, and I have to keep all these records from mm-hmm. every batch and have it tied to, if you, you know, see our cheese packaging, it says made on that date. And that can be tied back to my pasteurization records and the antibiotic test records and everything, you know. So if there's a problem or anything like that, I can go back and I have all the records of everything.
Okay, so you're pasteurizing, but you're not homogenizing.
I am not homogenizing.
Okay.
And I'm not doing any separating or anything. It's just
so
whole
it's
milk
whole,
as
the
is.
Whole thing that – okay, and so then you get your pasteurization done and you've got warm milk. Then what happens?
Then I cool it down again. So it takes maybe an hour to heat it up. to the pasteurization temperature, half an hour of pasteurizing, and then maybe 45 minutes to cool it back down. I want to be really careful about cleanliness, so I don't wear farm clothes into the processing area.
Okay, so yeah, you're not going out into the barn and back into
the cheeser.
Well, of course.
Cheese clothes, chore clothes. I could see the difference, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And I have done it. I have milked and done that, but it is crazy, and it's really hard. It takes a lot of focus. There are a lot of things that I can do to fill the time. You know, there is maintaining cheeses in the aging room because I have to brush them regularly, and there's a lot of cleaning. I spend probably most of my cheese making time actually washing dishes, cleaning floors, cleaning walls.
It's amazing,
you name
isn't it? Yep.
Good for you. So after you've heated, cooled, or then you turn it in, then you end up with pasteurized milk, and the next step is
adding culture. So I purchase a freeze-dried culture, bacterial culture. It's kind of similar to like the yeast packets that you get. So it looks like a powder, but you have to keep it cool when you're storing it.
So that way you have control over what bacterial input is going in there, right?
Right. You haven't completely killed everything with the pasteurization, but essentially what you're putting in the culture is what is there.
That'll
for
be the
your,
dominant bacterial.
Yeah, and it's growth. A mix of several different ones.
Okay.
So I measure how much I have for that day, and you know how much milk is in the vat that day, and then I weigh out my culture and you know do my calculations and add it on top, stir it in, and then I let it sit for 1 to 2 hours, depending on the cheese.
So
and it's coming alive.
You're,
it's kind of like
mozzarella.
Well, mozzarella or provolone are kind of the two things.
And it comes alive.
Yeah. So essentially, like, you know, kind of like the yeast, you're adding it to the water, and then it's like saying perking up. It's saying, "Ooh, this is a good temperature. Oh, there's some moisture. Ooh, look, there's a food source, too. Mm-hmm. This is really good." And it starts to come alive, and then, as it comes alive, then it starts to replicate, and it starts to ferment and so forth. And, so then after it has started to come alive and start to ferment a little bit.
And how do you know when it's happy? And I mean, like with bread, it rises. What happens? How do you tell with milk?
pH.
Oh. Little test strip.
I have a pH meter because I take a lot of measurements, and the pH strips are a very rough
messy
measurement.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so you got a pH meter. Generally. We're talking cheese. We're talking cheese with Kevin Dietzel. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
So we're talking about the cheese-making process. So, Kevin?
Where we left off, I had added culture, let it sit for an hour, and then I add rennet.
Rennet.
Which is an enzyme, which...
Does it really come from the cow's stomach anymore, or is it...
It does.
It still does.
What I
a
use...
A real rennet.
You can get a... What is called vegetarian rennet, but it is actually... What is usually called vegetarian rennet is actually bacterial rennet. So it's a GMO product that is created. It is identical to what comes from the calf stomach, but it is created by bacteria.
But you're using the real thing.
I'm using the real thing because, I don't know, I feel like it's more genuine and...
Well, plus you have a biodynamic organic operation going on there.
Yeah, there you go. I can see arguments for not taking it from a calf stomach and so forth, because it has to be a calf, because it's the enzyme that calves use to break down the milk for their own nutrition.
Oh, really?
So does this come from basically harvesting veal? Is that where it's coming from?
Probably. Yeah. I assume so. Mm-hmm.
Well, we do that. I mean,
and so something has to take the liquid and turn it into something that's more solid. The rennet does
that. That's what the rennet does. So the rennet is...
So it's a coagulant, basically?
It's a coagulant. That's exactly what it is. I don't want to get too much into the chemistry of it, but it's essentially cleaving the bond between the water and the protein, because those proteins and fats, they don't want to stay in a liquid form when they're in milk, and it's cleaving those bonds, and then they clump together.
Cleaving means cutting them, right?
Enzymatically cutting them. Uh-huh. And that takes about an hour for that to turn into almost like jello.
Have blobs floating in.
No, it's a one solid mass.
Ah,
and then I cut the curd into like 3/8 inch. Cubes. So I have...
It's kind of a fun process to watch.
It is fun. I have what I call curd knives or curd harps, which
curd
are...
Curd harps.
Well, because they look like harps.
They're
2 feet wide and about 4 feet high, 4 feet long, and they have wires. One is vertical and one is horizontal, so I do the vertical one first and then the horizontal one in order to cut it.
Is this something you just sort of sink into the milk tank and draw it?
Yeah, I kind of put it down in there and drag it kind of in a grid pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And you're cutting first columns with the vertical one, and then you cut those columns into cubes.
Well, it
slice and dice.
The resulting curds are lovely. It's fresh. You can really taste... You can taste the milk. Well, you can taste the cow. But you have plain cheese curds, plain, which are lovely. But then you have branched out and you put other tastes with things. When do you put the other flavorings with your cheese curds?
Well, it's actually so the cheese curds that you see here, they're not. Mm-hmm. This is not what's cut with the cheese with the curd knife.
Okay.
With the curd knife, I'm cutting it, and that is letting that's increasing the surface area of the curd, and then it pushes the water pushes the whey out.
Then
it all settles to the bottom.
The curds
and then
go to
I
the
let,
bottom, and you've got...
And then I let the whey drain out,
okay,
and I
so
just collect it in buckets.
Okay, so whey is essentially the water. And
it's water and all the water-soluble components, which are mostly the sugars, which is lactose.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some water-soluble proteins. And so that all goes out. And the fresh whey smells so fantastic.
Well, and it has some good nutrition, right?
Yeah, it's really good for you.
A lot of new athletic protein drinks are made with dried whey these days. So what are you doing with your whey?
One of my employees who helps part-time on the farm is a beginning farmer himself.
Tom Wilson.
And he has pigs, and so he is
taking
the whey to
his
farm. Remnant Hills Farm.
Remnant Hills. So he will have whey-fed pigs now.
Yes.
So this is one of those things where young farmers are cooperating. Something that is a so-called waste product, whey, on one farm turns into extremely high-quality feed for another farm.
Yeah. So back to the process. After it settles,
cut the curds. Drain the whey,
and then the solid portion settles to the bottom of the vat, and it turns, and then all those chunks kind of get globbed together.
Right. This is the beginning process for many types of cheese.
Cheeses. So what I've described, the cultures would be different. The temperatures would be slightly different. The times would be slightly different. Your goal pHs would be slightly different for depending on the type of cheese you're making. But the whole process would be the same for almost every cheese.
Okay. So then what makes them different after this?
Well, so if I am going to make cheese curds, I take a long knife and I cut chunks out of that solid in the bottom, and then I take it, put it on my cutting board, take my big knife, and I cut it into the cheese curd shapes.
Oh, so these are all hand cut?
They're hand cut.
Oh, my. Is that the point where you add the flavorings in then?
Yeah, so then I'm essentially, I have a big, big bowl, and I add some salt, and I add, whatever other herbs I want to add, and I just mix it in by hand. Well, we have what has been the favorite is dill garlic. Then we have a what we call French, but it's Herbes de Provence. So it's an herb mix. It has several different herbs, and then an Italian herb mix.
I would think that these curds could be treated kind of the way fettas are, and marinated in olive oil and further herbs, chop up some jalapenos, and of course I would add a little onion or garlic and some olive oil, and let the curds rest in that for a while. You would end up with some pretty tasty stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cheese curds, and that would be, I'm following a mozzarella recipe, so it's mozzarella cultures and so forth, which are a thermophilic, so that means that they thrive in a higher temperature than the mesophilic, which is a lower temperature culture, which is cheddar and jack, and a lot of other cheeses are mesophilic.
Been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. Today we talked about cows, robotic milking. Who knew? Robotic milking and cheese curds, mulberries, and we had some news from the Ames Farmers Market. What a good summer so far. Hope you're enjoying it. Look for the KHOI Community Radio in the Ames 4th of July Parade. That's from 11 to noon on July 4th. Join us there. Join us. Walk with us. Wave at us. We'll wave at you. Don and I will be there. Yes, we will. You've had music today on the Donalana Kitchen by the Barnall Band, Bill Monroe, Bob Black. And we'll go out with a fine guitar and mandolin version of the Star-Spangled Banner by Norman and Nancy Blake. Enjoy this fine summer. Have some cheese curds. Celebrate, yes. Have a dandy 4th of July. This is the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal, and we've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Mm-hmm.